wall. He had been doing this only for a moment when there was a sudden click, and a section of the darkness slid aside. He caught a glimpse of a man silhouetted against a dimly lit background. Then the door closed again, and the darkness returned. It happened so swiftly that he had no chance to see anything of the room in which he was lying. An instant later, he was dazzled by the light of a powerful electric torch. The beam flickered across his face, held him steadily for a moment, then dipped to illuminate the whole bed, which was, he now saw, nothing more than a mattress supported on rough planks. Out of the darkness, a soft voice spoke to him in excellent English, but with an accent which Stormgren could not at first identify.
"Ah, Mr. Secretary, I'm glad to see you're awake. I hope you feel quite all right."
There was something about the last sentence that caught Stormgren's attention, so that the angry questions he had been about to ask died upon his lips. He stared back into the darkness, then replied calmly, "How long have I been unconscious?" The other chuckled.
"Several days. We were promised there'd be no after effects. I'm glad to see it's true."
Partly to gain time, partly to test his own reactions, Stormgren swung his legs over the side of the bed. He was still wearing his night clothes, but they were badly crumpled and seemed to have gathered considerable dirt. As he moved, he felt a slight dizziness, not enough to be unpleasant, but sufficient to convince him that he had indeed been drugged. He turned towards the light.
"Where am I?" he said sharply. "Does Wainwright know about this?"
"Now don't get excited," replied the shadowy figure. "We won't talk about that sort of thing yet. I guess you're pretty hungry. Get dressed and come along to dinner."
The oval of light slipped across the room, and for the first time Stormgren had an idea of its dimensions. It was scarcely a room at all, for the walls seemed bare rock, roughly smoothed into shape. He realized that he was underground, possibly at a great depth. And if he had been unconscious for several days, he might be anywhere on Earth. The torchlight illuminated a pile of clothes draped over a packing case.
"This should be enough for you," said the voice from the darkness. "Laundry's rather a problem here, so we grabbed a couple of your suits and half a dozen shirts."
"That," said Stormgren without humor, "was very considerate of you."
"We're sorry about the absence of furniture and electric light. This place is convenient in some ways, but it rather lacks amenities."
"Convenient for what?"
asked Stormgren as he climbed into a shirt. The feel of the familiar cloth beneath his fingers was strangely reassuring.
"Just convenient," said the voice. "And by the way, since we're likely to spend a good deal of time together, you'd better call me Joe."
"Despite your nationality," retorted Stormgren. "You're Polish, aren't you? I think I could pronounce your real name. It won't be any worse than many Finnish ones."
There was a slight pause, and the light flickered for an instant.
"Well, I should have expected it," said Joe resignedly. "You must have plenty of practice at this sort of thing."
"It's a useful hobby for a man in my position. At a guess, I should say you were brought up in the United States, but didn't leave Poland until—"
"That," said Joe firmly, "is quite enough. As you seem to have finished dressing, thank you."
The door opened as Stormgren walked towards it, feeling mildly elated by his small victory. As Joe stood aside to let him pass, he wondered if his captor was armed. Almost certainly he would be, and in any case, he would have friends around. The corridor was dimly lit by oil lamps at intervals, and for the first time Stormgren could see Joe clearly. He was a man of about 50, and must have weighed well over 200 pounds. Everything about him was outsize, from the stained battle dress that might have come from any of half a dozen armed forces, to the startlingly large signet ring on his left hand. A man built on this scale probably would not bother to carry a gun. It should not be difficult to trace him, thought Stormgren, if he ever got out of this place. He was a little depressed to realize that Joe must also be perfectly well aware of this fact. The walls around them, though occasionally faced with concrete, were mostly bare rock. It was clear to Stormgren that he was in some disused mine, and he could think of few more effective prisons. Until now, the fact of his kidnapping had failed to worry him greatly. He had felt that, whatever happened, the immense resources of the overlords would soon locate and rescue him. Now he was not so sure. He had already been gone several days, and nothing had happened. There must be a limit even to Corellan's power, and if he were indeed buried in some remote continent, all the science of the overlords might be unable to trace him. There were two other men sitting at the table in the bare, dimly lit room. They looked up with interest, and more than a little respect, as Stormgren entered. One of them pushed across a bundle of sandwiches, which Stormgren accepted eagerly. Though he felt extremely hungry, he could have done with a more interesting meal. But it was very obvious that his captors had dined no better. As he ate, he glanced quickly at the three men around him. Joe was by far the most outstanding character, and not merely in the matter of physical bulk. The others were clearly his assistants, nondescript individuals whose origins Stormgren would be able to place when he heard them talk. Some wine had been produced in a not too aseptic glass, and Stormgren washed down the last of the sandwiches. Feeling now more fully in command of the situation, he turned to the huge Pole.
"Well," he said evenly, "perhaps you'll tell me what all this is about, and just what you hope to get out of it."
Joe cleared his throat.
"I'd like to make one thing straight," he said. "This has nothing to do with Wainwright. He'll be as surprised as anyone."
Stormgren had half expected this, though he wondered why Joe was confirming his suspicions. He had long suspected the existence of an extremist movement inside, or on the frontiers of, the Freedom League.
"As a matter of interest," he said, "how did you kidnap me?"
He hardly expected a reply to this, and was somewhat taken aback by the other's readiness, even eagerness, to answer.
"It was all rather like a Hollywood thriller," said Joe cheerfully. "We weren't sure if Corellan kept a watch on you, so we took somewhat elaborate precautions. You were knocked out by gas in the air conditioner. That was easy. Then we carried you out into the car. No trouble at all. All this, I might say, wasn't done by any of our people. We hired, professionals for the job. Corellan may get them. In fact, he's supposed to. But he'll be no wiser. When it left your house, the car drove into a long road tunnel not 1,000 kilometers from New York. It came out again on schedule at the opposite end, still carrying a drugged man extraordinarily like the Secretary General. Quite a while later, a large truck loaded with metal cases emerged in the opposite direction and drove to a certain airfield where the cases were loaded aboard a freighter on perfectly legitimate business. I'm sure the owners of those cases would be horrified to know how we employed them. Meanwhile, the car that had actually done the job continued elaborate evasive action towards the Canadian border. Perhaps Corellan's caught it by now. I don't know or care. As you'll see, I do hope you appreciate my frankness. Our whole plan depended on one thing. We're pretty sure that Corellan can see and hear everything that happens on the surface of the Earth. But unless he uses magic, not science, he can't see underneath it. So he won't know about the transfer in the tunnel, at least until it's too late. Naturally, we've taken a risk, but there were also one or two other safeguards I won't go into now. We may want to use them again, and it would be a pity to give them away."
Joe had related the whole story with such obvious gusto that Stormgren could hardly help smiling. Yet he also felt very disturbed. The plan was an ingenious one, and it was quite possible that Corellan had been deceived. Stormgren was not even certain that the Overlord kept any form of protective surveillance over him, nor, clearly, was Joe. Perhaps that was why he had been so frank. He wanted to test Stormgren's reactions. Well, he would try to appear confident, whatever his real feelings might be.
"You must be a lot of fools," said Stormgren scornfully, "if you think you can trick the overlords as easily as this. In any case, what conceivable good will it do?"
Joe offered him a cigarette, which Stormgren refused, then lit one himself and sat on the edge of the table. There was an ominous creaking, and he jumped off hastily.
"Our motives," he began, "should be pretty obvious. We found argument useless, so we have to take other measures. There have been underground movements before, and even Karelin, whatever powers he's got, won't find it easy to deal with us. We're out to fight for our independence. Don't misunderstand me. There'll be nothing violent, at first anyway. But the overlords have to use human agents, and we can make it mighty uncomfortable for them."
"Starting with me, I suppose," thought Stormgren. He wondered if the other had given him more than a fraction of the whole story. Did they really think that these gangster methods would influence Karelin in the slightest? On the other hand, it was quite true that a well-organized resistance movement could make life very difficult. For Joe had put his finger on the one weak spot in the Overlord's rule. Ultimately, all their orders were carried out by human agents. If these were terrorized into disobedience, the whole system might collapse. It was only a faint possibility, for Stormgren felt confident that Karelin would soon find some solution.
"What do you intend to do with me?" asked Stormgren at length. "Am I a hostage or what?"
"Don't worry, we'll look after you. We expect some visitors in a few days, and until then, we'll entertain you as well as we can."
He added some words in his own language, and one of the others produced a brand new pack of cards.
"We got these especially for you," explained Joe. "I read in Time the other day that you were a good poker player."
His voice suddenly became grave.
"I hope there's plenty of cash in your wallet," he said anxiously.
"We never thought of looking. After all, we can hardly accept checks."
Quite overcome, Stormgren stared blankly at his captors. Then, as the true humor of the situation sank into his mind, it suddenly seemed to him that all the cares and worries of office had lifted from his shoulders. From now on, it was Van Ryberg's show. Whatever happened, there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. And now these fantastic criminals were anxiously waiting to play poker with him. Abruptly, he threw back his head and laughed as he had not done for years. There was no doubt, thought Van Ryberg morosely, that Wainwright was telling the truth. He might have his suspicions, but he did not know who had kidnapped Stormgren, nor did he approve of the kidnapping itself. Van Ryberg had a shrewd idea that for some time extremists in the Freedom League had been putting pressure on Wainwright to make him adopt a more active policy. Now they were taking matters into their own hands. The kidnapping had been beautifully organized, there was no doubt of that. Stormgren might be anywhere on Earth, and there seemed little hope of tracing him. Yet something must be done, Van Ryberg decided, and done quickly. Despite the jests he had so often made, his real feeling towards Karelin was one of overwhelming awe. The thought of approaching the supervisor directly filled him with dismay, but there seemed no alternative. The communications section occupied the entire top floor of the great building. Lines of facsimile machines, some silent, some clicking busily, stretched away into the distance. Through them poured endless streams of statistics, production figures, census returns, and all the bookkeeping of a world economic system. Somewhere up in Karelin's ship must lie the equivalent of this great room, and Van Ryberg wondered, with a tingling of the spine, what shapes moved to and fro collecting the messages that Earth was sending to the overlords. But today, he was not interested in these machines and the routine business they handled. He walked to the little private room that only Stormgren was supposed to enter. At his instructions, the lock had been forced, and the chief communications officer was waiting there for him.
"It's an ordinary teleprinter, standard typewriter keyboard," he was told. "There's a facsimile machine as well, if you want to send any pictures or tabular information, but you said you wouldn't be needing that."
Van Ryberg nodded absently.
"That's all, thanks," he said. "I don't expect to be here very long. Then get the place locked up again and give me all the keys."
He waited until the communications officer had left, and then sat down at the machine. It was, he knew, very seldom used, since nearly all business between Karelin and Stormgren was dealt with at their weekly meetings. Since this was something of an emergency circuit, he expected a fairly quick reply. After a moment's hesitation, he began to tap out his message with unpracticed fingers. The machine purred away quietly, and the words gleamed for a few seconds on the darkened screen. Then he leaned back and waited for the answer. Scarcely a minute later, the machine started to whir again. Not for the first time, Van Ryberg wondered if the supervisor ever slept. The message was as brief as it was unhelpful.
No information. Leave matters entirely to your discretion. K.
Rather bitterly, and without any satisfaction at all, Van Ryberg realized how much greatness had been thrust upon him. During the past 3 days, Stormgren had analyzed his captors with some thoroughness. Joe was the only one of any importance. The others were non-entities, the riffraff one would expect any illegal movement to gather round itself. The ideals of the Freedom League meant nothing to them. Their only concern was earning a living with the minimum of work. Joe was an altogether more complex individual, though sometimes he reminded Stormgren of an overgrown baby. Their interminable poker games were punctuated with violent political arguments, and it soon became obvious to Stormgren that the big Pole had never thought seriously about the causes for which he was fighting. Emotion and extreme conservatism clouded all his judgments. His country's long struggle for independence had conditioned him so completely that he still lived in the past. He was a picturesque survival, one of those who had no use for an ordered way of life. When his type vanished, if it ever did, the world would be a safer but less interesting place. There was now little doubt, as far as Stormgren was concerned, that Karelin had failed to locate him. He had tried to bluff, but his captors were unconvinced. He was fairly certain that they had been holding him here to see if Karelin would act, and now that nothing had happened, they could proceed with their plans. Stormgren was not surprised when, a few days later, Joe told him to expect visitors. For some time, the little group had shown increasing nervousness, and the prisoner guessed that the leaders of the movement, having seen that the coast was clear, were at last coming to collect him. They were already waiting, gathered round the rickety table, when Joe waved him politely into the living room. Stormgren was amused to note that his jailer was now wearing, very ostentatiously, a huge pistol that had never been in evidence before. The two thugs had vanished, and even Joe seemed somewhat restrained. Stormgren could see at once that he was now confronted by men of a much higher caliber, and the group opposite him reminded him strongly of a picture he had once seen of Lenin and his associates in the first days of the Russian Revolution. There was the same intellectual force, iron determination, and ruthlessness in these six men. Joe and his kind were harmless. Here were the real brains behind the organization. With a curt nod, Stormgren moved over to the only vacant seat and tried to look self-possessed. As he approached,